A couple of months ago, I had the pleasure of reading a brand new novel published by Fremantle Press called The Silence of Water. That link to Frio is present in the story as well, which pieces together the intergenerational family history of a teenage girl Fan, her mother Agnes, and grandfather Edwin. And like the family in the story, its author, Sharon Booth, is a British migrant to Australia, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
There you are.
Here I am.
It's the magic of live radio. If it can go wrong, it will. Now, tell us a little bit about these characters. Where did they come from? Because, I mean, they're well constructed and they're well rounded in a very humane way. You know, there's good, there's bad, but no one's really a villain. Where did they come from?
Well, I actually sort of stumbled across this story while I was researching something else, and I was interested in the colonial history, Western Australia's colonial history, and I had sort of gone down the equivalent of a YouTube rabbit hole in the state archives and with some of the research, and I stumbled across this story about a man who had been transported here to Western Australia as a convict in the 1860s. Now, I didn't really know much about our convict history at this stage, and I had kind of the understanding, the assumption that they were all, you know, really good men and jolly sheep stealer types who maybe stolen a loaf of bread and, you know, to feed their families. But this man was not like that at all. He was not a likable man. He was violent. He was a drinker. And there were many men like that who'd committed all kinds of serious crimes. He'd committed a very serious crime and yet had somehow been transported and was able to start a new life. And I became interested in how you can keep a secret that big in a life, and also how that might have affected the unspoken parts of his life. Those silences and the secrets might have affected future generations. And so I did a bit more research, and I sort of started off thinking I would be writing about convicts, but as a woman, I found the women characters that I sort of stumbled, the real figures that I stumbled across, far more interesting than the men, and or whose stories were worthy of really exploration, particularly because the women characters, a lot of the women characters, the way they were written about by others in the archives and in the media was terrible. And even if you could find anything about them at all, they were just fragments and traces about the women. And so I began to form a story about this man who had got away with something terrible and how that might affect his daughter, his granddaughter, and what might happen if some of those secrets came to light. And so that's how the story kind of began.
Well, I think you've really fulfilled your goal then, if it's to create these living, well-constructed female characters throughout the book. I mean, we've got Fan, we've got her mother, her mother's mother, we've got Edwin's sister. That's as well, right. And they're all such, I guess, visceral characters. You got a real sense of their inner lives.
Yeah, so that's what I was trying to achieve because, as I said, I think as a woman writer interested in women's stories, I found that first of all, Agnes, who was Edwin's daughter, had I sort of used the research, the facts such as they were, to start really prompt more questions than answers. And I found that's what really kept me awake at night. You know, I thought about, well, Agnes, she took off from Western Australia at a very young age. She would have been about 18 when she took off, and she headed to South Australia, and she built a whole life in Adelaide. She married there. She had her children there, including Fan, her daughter, and her two sons. And then suddenly we find her back in Fremantle looking after her old man. And I just wondered, I just started to ask questions. How would this impact on Agnes's daughter Fan, who was about that age where, you know, she was loving her life? So inspiration and creativity started to kind of filter through some of those facts. And I just began to wonder, no one takes off and doesn't come back for 20 years. And then why would she have done that? And why, as I started asking lots of questions, and then the writing just kind of happened. I wanted to find out why, so I wrote to find out why.
I'm really curious about, I guess, the logistics of the book, because time-wise it sort of goes in both directions. You've got multiple characters, their lives are all weaved together.
That's
and
right.
I really enjoyed that you could see how well threaded those stories were.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad that that was something that you picked up on, because it was a...
How did you manage the logistics? did you have to sit down and do the whole family tree and then write it chronologically, or was it more organic?
That's really well spotted, because that's exactly what I did. I'd originally planned to write a dual narrative, and then I was going to be Edwin's story and then maybe someone else's. I wasn't quite sure. But then what happened is I discovered this wonderful plot twist of Agnes, Edwin's Australian daughter, taking off to Adelaide to build a new life there. And I wanted to... I didn't want to not write about that too. So what I did originally is I actually wrote it chronologically, and I wrote it in three parts from the points of view of the three main characters, Edwin, his daughter Agnes, and her daughter Fan, and then I brought them together at the end because I wanted to see what would happen when I got these three people in a room and threw in a few family history hand grenades, you know. And so I wrote it chronologically. So I built really strong... I kind of built it with really strong bricks to start with. And the building blocks were very sound. And then what I did is... actually, in the process of editing, my editor just asked a very simple question. She said, "Have you ever thought about interweaving the narratives?" And I said, "Well, yes, of course I've thought about that. I really wanted to do it that way, but I just wasn't sure how." And I think the catalyst of that conversation, having constructed these building blocks, what I did then is I knew the story inside out. I knew these characters inside out. What I did then is I kind of rebuilt it in a different pattern with the three interwoven narratives. So the reader is able to meet Fan. The reader can meet Fan straight away, this feisty, curious, you know, sharp-witted, very single-minded young girl. The reader is able to find out about, sort of uncover these secrets and these lies and these... Everybody's lying about their family history and their story. The reader's able to discover those things as Fan does, and I felt that was a really powerful way for the reader to connect with the story. And also in my own experience, I think every family has secrets, and that's an aspect of this novel that people have really resonated with. Family secrets. And when, you know, those situations where, you know, you maybe see your cousins once a year at Christmas and you say, did your mum ever mention blah, blah? And then your cousin says, yes, but then she changed the subject, and it was all... We kind of find these things out in pieces and in fragments. We don't really tend to find those things out in a linear way. So I think the structure helps a reader to... the way that the story unfolds, a reader can really get a sense of lots of people telling lots of big fibs about the truth of their family history.
Mm. And not just fibbing, often sitting in silence.
Oh, yes. And plain old, and silence is a big theme of this book. And I think I was particularly interested when I discovered that Edwin had been was a convict originally transported here. There were 10,000 convicts transported to Western Australia, and I would have considered myself quite well read when I began this story, but I'd really never heard about any of our convicts besides, you know, we've maybe all heard of Moondyne Joe, who's this kind of mythical figure, and we've maybe heard of J.B. O'Reilly and the Fenians, who escaped and they left the colony. But what about the other guys? You know, there was a lot of them. Mm. And why have we not heard about them? And I really wanted to explore that and to perhaps put a character in fiction who wasn't your typical good-hearted man or wrongly convicted. He was a difficult guy. And what about those guys? And what about the impact of those silences on our big history as well as our individual ones?
You're listening to an interview with Sharon Booth, author of The Silence of Water. It's interesting what you mentioned there about him not being a good guy. I mean, he did a bad thing, a terrible thing, but he still wasn't necessarily unlikable in a sense. Because you understand the context and the trauma and the damage that is done to him.
Yes.
How difficult is it to write a likable bad man?
That is a really good question, and I still don't know whether I've got that right. But I, what I did was I did a lot of historical research, and I used what I could find. He seemed to be the kind of guy who started off in a really promising way. He was a tailor by trade, like his father was. He was a smart man. He was well read. Got the 19th century equivalent of an upgrade in his class because he joined the excise service. So he had a clerical profession. And then, of course, his life goes really, really wrong, and he takes no responsibility for it at all, which was, for me, the hardest thing. He blames everyone else for everything that happens in his life. He blames the women for everything that happens to him, and he's living in a society that actually allows that to happen. And it was really hard to write about him. I didn't want to... I wanted to try and be as true to the character as I could. And I think as a writer, what really interested me... Facts and figures are great, but what really interested me as a writer is I knew I needed... the facts told me I needed to get to a certain point about things that occurred, but I just wanted to explore how does someone go so wrong? And yet what might happen, you know, he got away with a lot, and I wanted to kind of, I knew down the track that there was some accountability, there was a moment coming for him, and I wanted to see what would happen when those three people were in a room together. And he was finally called into account in a very unexpected way, and I wanted to see what would happen to him. So that helped, knowing he was getting his comeuppance at some point.
We've talked a lot about the human characters, but I think the other character in the novel really is the ocean. And such almost filmic descriptions of the ocean, fans time, not just in the ocean, but also the river.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. And that's also why I mentioned, you know, I thought there was something in the way that you described the natural elements that I think is very clear to migrants.
Yes.
Who are unfamiliar and not raised in this intense bleach sky brightness and the sharpness of the landscape here.
Yeah. That's a really good question because I was a migrant myself. I was one of the 10-pound POM generation. I came out, I was almost 10 years old with my family. My parents are working class people, moved here for a better life for their family on little more than having read a brochure, as thousands and thousands of English people did at the time. And I some of my, I guess, my formative memories were on that ship. We arrived, we took about, it was almost a month on a migrant ship. And some of my most intense memories of that time were of sitting on the deck, just watching this, you've just never known an enormous expanse of sea like it. And just feeling this sense of, wow, I was nearly 10 years old and I'd suddenly understood that everything that you knew to be certain could be taken away from you. It could just go, even the land under your feet. And so I think I've kind of probably given that. I mean, in the Silence of Water, Edwin is transported and actually has terrible memories of the sea and that experience of being of that dislocation, and yet it allowed him to start a new life. Agnes, his daughter, took off again across a large body of water and decided to try and start a new life in Adelaide. And Fan is transported against her will, as her grandfather observes. They're both in exile when she has to come back to Fremantle, and she doesn't want to leave Adelaide. And so I think I kind of that experience of putting an ocean between you and a part of your life is something that I was possibly always wanting to write about in some way. And this story, it's parts of this story that I discovered were touch points for me. And I think what you said about the landscape here is absolutely right. You just never, I've found it personally, that you just, I have never been able to look at it and feel it as less than a kind of transcendent being in the water. I'm a water person. I love being in the ocean, and I think I've given that to Fan in the story. And I think that was one of those instances where I knew that the family had lived in this beautiful area around Port Adelaide and Semaphore and Largs. And once I'd Googled these places and had a look and thought, wow, that's amazing. I have to go there. Went there, walked on the beach, experienced this magic as a visitor. Again, with that little bit of distance and that was it. Fan was the water baby, and that's how... And that is one of the bigger aspects of the story, is the way that we can try and put an ocean between our old selves and today. But as the old saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. Mm. It's not always possible to escape.
Now, you mentioned that this story started with you sort of ferreting in the archives.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, what brought you into the archives initially? What was that original project?
The original project was a long time ago now. I was researching the life of a prison warder who was a family ancestor of someone that I knew. And this man had come out as a settler, as they were called. We know it wasn't settlement, we know it was occupation, but back then he'd come out as a free settler, and he had got a job as a night warder at the colonial prison, worked his way up through the system, and became quite senior in the prison system. And he'd had a pretty ordinary, just a normal, unremarkable employment history, except for this one little side note in his employment history, which said that a woman, a female prisoner, had accused him and another warder of assaulting her when she was an inmate in Perth Prison. And this very brave woman had written a letter to the authorities making these allegations. And she had... Her letters, I've read them, her letter and the responses, she was just summarily dismissed. There's a scribble across one corner of the letter that basically says, well, we can't believe what she says because she's a female prisoner, and we all know that, you know, they have low moral character and they tell lies, a tissue of falsehoods or some other typical colonial patriarchal expression. And I was reading this and just thought, wow, I want to know more about this brave woman. This woman turns out to be Annie Edwards, who married Edwin Salt. Mm. And in the novel, when we first meet Edwin, he's married to Annie, his third wife. And so I kind of came to this story through another silenced woman, Annie, and she kind of plays a minor role in The Silence of Water, but it was her story that really was the catalyst for me discovering all these other very interesting things about these people.
I'm glad I asked, because I feel like I suddenly have a missing piece to Edwin's story.
Yes.
That anger and sense of injustice and need for... confrontation, I guess, that I could imagine you felt reading that correspondence.
Oh, man. Yeah,
I think,
it was
hard. He gets that visited upon him, perhaps not in an ideal way, but at least on some level.
Yeah, I there was a lot of as a female writer, I felt there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of pain and sadness in reading the stories. Annie's story in particular was, again, sadly not uncommon. She wasn't believed because of that circular argument, well, we can't believe you because you're a female prisoner, so why would you be telling the truth? And that some years later there was an inquiry at the end of the 1890s, I think about 1899, round about then, where treatment such as Annie had received turned out to be quite common. So it was revealed that it was quite common. So she was vindicated many years later, but by then I guess it was too late for her. And all of the women in this story were silenced and vilified and marginalised in some way. And I just felt a bit outraged at the patriarchy and about how I, as a contemporary woman living in these times, there were threads of similarities between how women are represented in the media now and some of the things I had read that were 100 and nearly 200 years old. And that's what put the fire in, you know, in me about writing. I really wanted to... I wanted to restore some dignity to particularly Marianne, and I wanted to give a voice to, as best I could, to some of the other women who had been very either ignored or the only time you saw them in the archives is when they were subject to some kind of criminal proceedings, and usually after they had spoken their truth to power. Once a woman had used her voice, that was often when she found herself in trouble. So I wanted to do something about that.
Well, we have very much run out of time together, but I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Me too, Tom. Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And thank you for writing the book. It was a real pleasure to read. It's one that has stuck with me after the fact, which I think...
Oh, I'm so glad. I've done my job, if that's the case.
Well, thank you very much. And for folks who are interested, it is available now?
Yes, it is. All good bookshops.
Excellent. That was author Sharon Booth, author of The Silence of Water, published by Fremantle Press, having a chat there about her characters, their lives, internal, external, and the historical origins of that story.